dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The intelligence of Robert Charles is something we have the privilege of plumbing from time to time. He is, of course, a former Assistant Secretary of State in the George W. Bush administration, where he was responsible for the Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs Division of the State Department. He is the author of Eagles and Evergreens and a very active contributor in his role at the Charles Group with the Association of Mature American Citizens, for whom he is a spokesman and a very gifted contributor. Bobby Charles, it's good to have you back. Thank you for joining us, as always. We're going to be talking a lot in the course of the program today, Bobby, about the coronavirus and the economy and what it portends for our country. I thought I might start with some things that you've been mulling in your AMAC column about the politics of all of this and the conditions of our polity, I guess I might say, in general at this particular moment. What are your thoughts?
Well, I appreciate that, Frank. And as you noted, I am the spokesperson for AMAC, AMAC.us, which represents conservative Americans over the age of 50. And I think that's particularly relevant right now as you look at this sort of confluence here of coronavirus, primaries, Democratic candidates, and a sense of sort of confusion in the national political marketplace. And why do I say that? Because actually 35% of all of the voters who turn out, if you look at Pew studies, 35% of the voters are over the age of 50, and 25% of all voters are over the age of 65. And that's very significant because they vote 2-to-1 more conservative than they do vote liberal. What has happened in the last, with Super Tuesday and the sequence of events from a vast field of Democratic candidates to then essentially two candidates, Sanders and Biden, is that you've seen here of course, Super Tuesday was created in order to try to stabilize their primary process, and it doesn't seem to have done that. What you see here is that the young voters in virtually all of these states are not turning out. Sanders thought all these young voters would turn out, and although he won California, the reality is that these voters are turning out at a much lower level, in some cases half the level that they turned out in 2016, which is in turn lower than the turnout for Obama in 2008. So what does that portend for the future, and particularly in the context of these crises that we're facing? What it portends is that the Democrats are in a desperate moment. They really have two candidates, a socialist who is completely off the wall in terms of any connection to the average American. And by the way, the young voters don't seem to be turning out for him after all, either because they really want a Trump job or because they don't believe in socialism after all, or because a 78-year-old and a 77-year-old are not their idea of being hip. So at the end of the day, their candidates are weak. And Biden, of course, you know, who seems to be the leader at the moment, is having real cognitive problems. And I'm not kidding here. I mean, they go beyond gaffes. At a certain point, gaffes become a healthcare question and a cogency question. And that's pretty significant here. And so I say that they're in a tough situation. And I think the Democratic Party itself is in a moment of a sort of national desperation, which is why you see a Speaker of the House ripping up a State of the Union address, is why you see a minority leader in the Senate essentially speaking out in really harsh terms against and seeming to threaten two conservative members of the Supreme Court. There's a real desperation. And the coronavirus overlay, never mind this oil shock that we've seen this week, it really just adds to their sense of desperation. I think the reason you see all the crisis built around this coronavirus is part real and part not real. And the way it will feed back into the election is that if we're still talking about the coronavirus in November, we're going to have a problem. But I honestly don't think we're going to be there. I think this is going to pass. And yet again, the Democrats will have tried to turn a crisis into some political advantage, as they've tried now for 3 years, and it won't really have gone anywhere.
When you look at this, this is a very important point. My impression had been that the young cohort has now been so indoctrinated with the socialist or even communist sort of Kool-Aid that the likelihood is that we're going to see, if not fully in this election, certainly in those to come, them both dominating the Democratic Party and the choice of its nominee and its platform and its agenda, and if, heaven forbid, it's actually given a mandate by the American people, you know, full-on sort of socialist at best sort of policymaking. You're telling us that based on at least the turnout statistics to date, there's hope on the score.
Yeah, so don't get me wrong, Frank. I share your concerns, and I shared them up to the Super Tuesday period, and I share them now. And that is that socialism, of course, is just a way station on the way to communism, and it is a disaster. It either ends in disaster before it gets to communism or when it gets there. And you know, the historical precedents are global, and they go back more than 100 years, and we know what we're talking about here. There's no question that socialism is a dead-end street and scary. But I think what the young vote not turning out suggests is that there's a lot less enthusiasm for this sort of new wave thinking than we may have thought. Or maybe it's the candidates. I mean, obviously, again, I'll just say that Sanders and Biden do not show up as sort of John Kennedy, never mind Harry Truman. And so reality is maybe it's just the unappealingness of the candidates. I'm not suggesting for a minute we take our eyes off the ball. We do not want this country to become Venezuela, Cuba, or the Soviet Union. And that is where it would go if you subscribed to these socialist, you know, give away everything and penalize people with class warfare mentality. But I'm more of an optimist because I think that people are coming to their senses. And in the election this year, I think even a number of young people will realize that their best economic and security future lies with the Republican Party.
Bobby, you also had a piece that was stunning, and I don't know whether it's, you know, a snapshot that is being overtaken by events, but tell us a little bit about the crime statistics that we've seen most recently from the FBI and what that suggests about the state not only of our economy, but also of public safety.
So very good point, and it's not one that's commonly discussed, and that is that when you have a good economy, and this is the best economy in 50 years, in some sectors in 60 years, you have low unemployment, you have high growth, you have more labor participation, you have a greater sense of personal security among those who are in the workplace and those who benefit in a family from that's in the workplace, you end up typically seeing an increase in public safety. And that's exactly what you're seeing here. Of course, the same thing happens in reverse. When you end up in a recession or you end up in a dramatic downturn, you end up seeing public safety problems. You see an increase in violent crime and personal crime. So one of the unspoken realities here that I think should encourage people, again, I'm not saying that the world is a completely safe place, nor the United States, but many of the cities, and I accept right now there are some cities that are facing significant homicide rates, Baltimore, Chicago. But the reality is that the economic upturn has dramatically driven down both violent and personal crime across the United States. And that's a good news story.
Bobby Charles, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much, Mr. Secretary. Always good to have you with us. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. In the meantime, keep up the great work you do at the Charles Group and, of course, at the American Association of Mature American Citizens. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang. We'll get his take on what is happening in China and what it might mean for all of us, and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by one of the country's preeminent authorities on matters involving U.S. national security and other interests in Asia, most especially in communist China. His name, of course, is Gordon Chang. You can follow him at Gordon G. Chang at Twitter. He is also, of course, the author of three terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and, of course, most recently, Losing South Korea. Gordon, it was good to see you at CPAC recently. We'll talk about that in a moment, but I'm very keen to get your sort of latest assessment of the coronavirus and particularly what is the state of play in China. Welcome back, sir. It's good to have you.
Well, thank you so much, Frank. Beijing says that the virus is subsiding outside of Hubei province, Wuhan, and that may be true, but also there is information that there are clusters and spread of the virus in places like Beijing itself. I think that Xi Jinping has been managing the statistics because he wants workers to return to their job sites. There's a lot of information that shows that China, one way or another, is undercounting cases and also is creating information showing a recovery, where in many places there is no recovery or very little of a recovery. But we do know, Frank, that people are now going out in public because they have been encouraged by the information from the Communist Party. And therefore, I think this is going to prolong the epidemic as people reinfect each other. There's some evidence of reinfection and infections that are caused by this back-to-work order. And so this is going to be a much longer story for China than it had to be.
And Gordon, you've been tracking closely some of the evidence of malfeasance. Telling people to go back to work when it's not safe to do so is one evidence of it. But what do you know about the extent to which China withheld critical information, including about the genomic sequencing of this disease, for some 2 weeks?
Secretary of State Pompeo actually talked about this in an indirect fashion about 3 or 4 days ago when he talked about his incredible frustration with Beijing in terms of getting information about the coronavirus. We know that a World Health Organization team did eventually visit Wuhan, but it did so many, many, many weeks late, didn't stay very long. And we know that China did its best to prevent the virologists from actually studying the origin of the outbreak. And that has led, of course, to rumors about what Beijing is trying to hide. We don't know that yet with any degree of certainty, but we can suspect pretty much the worst in some cases.
And Gordon, worst might involve, among other things, the possibility that if they are dissembling about the actual state of recovery in China, and as you mentioned a moment ago, the possibility of reinfection once you've ostensibly recovered, with all that that means for disseminating the disease, having gone back to work or having, you know, re-entered society. This is potentially going to be something that is going to be with us for quite some time to come, not just in China, but elsewhere around the world as well, no?
Well, certainly. This bug is mutating, Frank, which means that it can reinfect, and it has been doing so with some regularity, not only in China, but elsewhere. Many people assume that because this is a coronavirus, that it will melt away in summer months. But we got to remember, though, that COVID-19 seems to like hot and humid weather, which it's not supposed to, because it's thrived in Singapore. And more important, it's thrived in the Middle East. So we don't know what's going to happen come June, July, Iran and the Emirates. So we don't know what's going to happen in July and August. And of course, people say that this could come back in September, largely because some coronaviruses do that as well.
Gordon, let me ask you, moving away from the virology, which you've become proficient at, to sort of the politics of this. What is happening inside China as you see it? I've seen reports that Xi Jinping's totalitarian crackdown has conduced to containing the virus and may even have helped consolidate his grip on power, but that it doesn't necessarily mean that he is more secure in the job. Walk us through what you think is happening within the Chinese Communist Party at the moment.
Well, clearly, Xi Jinping has used this as an opportunity to consolidate power, as you talk about. At least that's what he's attempting to do. But his handling has come in for intense criticism. And also, one other aspect of this, and that is many people suspected a long time ago, and we're starting to see evidence of this, that the controls that the party has put in place to contain the outbreak will remain even after the virus subsides. So that this is going to be used as an excuse to continue these totalitarian and semi-totalitarian measures. We know that there's a lot of unhappiness among people in China, and this is going to translate, I think, into a spring of discontent. It is going to be fascinating to watch how the regime reacts to this. But we can see a period like we saw, for instance, in 1989, of general unhappiness across the country that does lead to open protest.
I guess the question about open protests, as we've seen in Hong Kong, is whether people will be willing to, you know, take to the streets to engage in open protest under circumstances in which that can be potentially life-threatening. What is your take on that, Gordon? Is there any other vehicle for opposition to the regime to be expressed, especially in an era in which the Chinese Communist Party has now instituted, as you know so well, this social credit system for monitoring and ultimately punishing expression that they do not approve of?
Social credit systems like China will work in normal times, but in extraordinary times, and that's what we're heading to, Frank, people just don't care. They lose their fear. So you had a vice premier stroll around Wuhan about 4 or 5 days ago, and the delegation that she led was openly jeered by people from their balconies. That doesn't translate to people on the streets, but nonetheless, it shows the mentality is there, and that people are starting to lose their fear. And that's because social media postings before they're taken down signal to everyone that there's a lot of people out there who share the views of discontent. So remember the Chernobyl nuclear accident in the Ukraine took 5 years before the Soviet Union fell. In China, I think the process is going to be faster. I've been wrong about timing before, but nonetheless, you can see the elements are there.
Let me ask you about one other piece of this, Gordon. You mentioned that individuals are being summoned back to work. In some cases, it seems being coerced back to work in factories, in factory dormitories, in which it is almost certainly the case that the disease, if it is not indeed dwindling, is going to be proliferating dramatically. There have been disruptions in supply. There seems to be a pretty high likelihood, especially if reports that there are instances in which factories are, you know, using electricity and running their machines, but there's nobody actually working at them, that may become quite protracted. Two questions. One, is that something that is likely to further exacerbate the economic situation and therefore the political situation inside China? And secondly, is it going to catalyze the wholesale sort of restructuring of supply chains that we have been hearing President Trump talk about for some time now?
Well, on the first question, you're referring to reports that factories, in order to get quota for reopening, need to show prior activity. So they've been running and using up electricity in order to show that they actually are in operation when they are not. And this is just typical behavior in a communist state that is so goal-focused. I think that essentially there is going to be – China's maybe about operating at half capacity right now. We know that about two-thirds of the workers are back at work, but there are big disruptions. So it's not just factories that are shut down. I think even more important, some factories can actually operate, but they're not getting orders because foreign buyers realize that once they pay for goods as they are put on the factory dock, they can't assure that they can get them on the ship. It's the logistical supply chain from factory to port that really is the issue right now for China. You know, in terms of what the ultimate effect of this will be, I think that this will help companies decide to diversify, but there are other factors, and there are political factors that I think are going to be even more important, because as a nation, we realize we cannot rely on China for the supply of certain critical goods like pharmaceuticals, as Rosemary Gibson has told you on a number of occasions. Also, electronic goods, those that rely on rare earths, those that can be used to surveil on us. Those, I think, there's a political decision that we're just not going to buy from China. There are a number of factors right now that all argue towards a breakage of these linkages with China. And I think that they're going to become much more persuasive as time goes on. So it's not just a question of problems in China. It's also perceptions around the world to China's hostility and belligerence that are going to drive what people call the Great Decoupling.
Very quickly, Gordon, you were a very prominent feature of the Conservative Political Action Conference last week. I had a cameo appearance there myself and did some radio row work. And there's a report that an individual who attended had symptoms of the coronavirus detected afterwards. Any word on the public health concerns there?
Well, we know that Senator Ted Cruz said he had contact with that individual and is now self-quarantined himself in Texas, as has a representative from Arizona, Gosar. And that individual also had contact with Matt Schlapp, the president of the American Conservative Union. And that was before Schlapp actually shook the hand of the president on Saturday. So there is this concern, but it appears to be contained, and we will just have to see. But this says that, you know, in the future, these large gatherings are going to be constrained in some way. And this could very well affect the presidential campaign for both parties as they have to move away from rallies toward other forms of campaigning. We know, Frank, that Columbia University and Barnard are not having classes this week because there's a professor there who is tested positive. This is going to affect American society in very important ways. And that's why we're seeing, you know, the problems in the financial markets today.
Gordon, we will be monitoring all of it, as will you. Thank you for your time today, as well as your terrific contributions. Again, follow Gordon at Gordon G. Chang at Twitter, and do follow him back to us next week. Gordon, thank you. I hope to talk to you about all of this and more soon. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman. We'll get a little bit more on that shakeup in our own economy and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Kevin Freeman, our duty expert on matters involving economic warfare, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, I'm proud to say, with that specialization. He is also, of course, the host of Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman at Blaze TV. You can find out how to see it at economicwarroom.com. And he blogs at globaleconomicwarfare.com, where we came upon a terrific piece by him, which we will be talking about momentarily. Kevin is also the author of two terrific books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, and is just an extraordinary resource, not least for the work that he's doing at the National Security Investment Consultants Institute, about which we'll talk more here in a moment. Kevin Freeman, welcome back. It's so good to have you, as always. I wanted to talk with you about the coronavirus a little bit, Kevin. We've discussed it, got sort of an update on what's happening on the ground, particularly in China. But maybe if I could just ask you to give us a bit of a stock taking, if I can use that expression at the moment, given the volatilities of the stock market. What do you see happening in our economy as a result of what's clearly now roiling both the Chinese economy and its production lines, as well as world markets elsewhere?
Well, we saw the open this morning limit down, which means they stopped trading because the market went down more than 7% at the opening. It's massive panic. Indiscriminate selling, you know, gold has been up occasionally and briefly, but almost everything is in the red. And that is for fear that this virus will create a contagion that will literally shut down restaurants and movie theaters and so forth, so that people will hunker in their homes, won't leave their home either because they've been quarantined or because they're afraid. And that kind of panic is clearly having and will have an impact on our economy.
And to the extent that that's happening, is there any end in sight at the moment, or are we still in the early stages of what could be a very sizable sell-off?
You know, the funny thing is when we're talking about coronavirus, this is a novel coronavirus, and generally we hear the term common cold. This is essentially an uncommon cold. And if it stays in the nasal passages in the throat and just minor, 80, 90% of us will get past this with minor symptoms. But at some point, particularly the elderly, it gets into the lungs, and that's where damage is caused, mostly by the immune system's response. And I'm not a doctor, but elderly people tend to be hit much harder than this. We get past it, absolutely. We get past a pandemic every 25 to 30 years, I'm told. And as a result, you know, it hits the stock market, it hits the economy, we grow past it, life goes on for those that are lucky enough to survive, which should be 98%+ of us.
So you're taking the long view of this, obviously, and counseling doing the same with respect to the markets? I mean, this, I'm not asking you to pass out free advice here, but I'm just interested in your take.
No, absolutely. But what I'd like to say about the markets is the bigger threat is that people panic and react and toss in another administration. Last week, we had a circumstance where the looked like Super Tuesday primary dealt a big blow to socialist Joe Biden, and the markets reacted positively in the midst of this coronavirus. And to me, that's an indicator that the greater threat we're facing is the threat of bad decisions where we decide, well, we've got to remove President Trump and put in, XYZ candidate, whether it's Biden or whether it is Sanders. That is a serious threat. That's a problem because socialism is a greater long-term threat to our economy and to our lives than the coronavirus.
Tell us about that, Kevin, because that's a subject of, I think, a recent essay by you, and I'm very keen on exploring that. I don't disagree, needless to say, but I'm interested in what is it about socialism that you find, particularly, I assume, from the economic perspective, but political and strategic as well, that makes it more dangerous to an America than a deadly pandemic?
Well, first off, it's because, as Lynch said, socialism's purpose is to lead to communism. And when you look at democratically elected socialist leaders, and I don't mean faux socialism like Sanders likes to point to in Denmark and places in Europe. I'm talking about real socialism like they instituted in Venezuela. It ultimately ends in the collapse of the economy because it disincentivizes people from working. It's failed every time it's been tried, whether it was the Plymouth Colony. When the first pilgrims came here, they attempted socialism, and it failed miserably, and people died, to the horrifying experiment of the Soviet Union and China today. And if you want to even look, there are like 100 million people that were killed under communist regimes in the last 100 years. If you look today at China and the way that they're responding to this crisis and the way that they're denying freedoms, the way that they're literally, people died in a collapsed hotel. There are all sorts of horrifying stories coming out of this. Organ transplant, somebody was saved with a lung transplant by killing somebody to take the lungs to do it. The things the Committee on the Present Danger China is pointing out, those are true, and that's where socialism ultimately leads. And once socialism gets a grip on the government, it's very rare for the people to turn back to freedoms because they start consolidating power. And so you read repeatedly, I thought, and there's a brilliant essay that came out regarding the Iranian Revolution. I thought the Iranian Revolution would bring freedom. I was wrong. The same mechanisms that bring about socialism or what took place in Iran in the late 1970s.
It's a revolutionary agenda that brings about totalitarianism, whether it's got a god on top of it or not. It's communism, and it definitely is inimical to freedom for the people most immediately involved, and it's a danger to the rest of us, for heaven's sakes. Kevin, let me just ask you about one other piece of this, and that is that to the extent that there's any silver lining, as I was talking about with Gordon Chang, it may be that the kind of policy agenda that President Trump has been encouraging, namely a disengagement from China, a freeing of us from supply chains that are highly problematic, dependencies in China, medicine, among many others. How is that translating, as you see it, on the ground, both in China and with respect to manufacturers or purveyors of goods in this country?
Well, first off, we should give President Trump credit. The fact that he woke American companies up to the reality that our supply chains were wholly dependent on communist China gave some opportunity. I don't know how many companies took advantage of it. Some did. That we should adjust where we get the manufacturing of goods, bring it home where possible, find more allied countries to do business with where possible. And the reality is some did, and that awareness is a huge benefit for those that are facing this crisis because the vast majority of the COVID-19 cases remain in mainland China. It shut factories, and so we have shortages. They're not shortages caused by our president. In fact, it would be far worse had we been more in bed with the communist Chinese. Thank goodness for President Trump helping us that. But we have serious ones like the prescription drug one that we talk about with Rosemary Gibson. You've had her on your program. We are very dependent on Chinese medicines. We are now aware of how dangerous that dependence is, both from a geopolitical standpoint, but also from a health standpoint with COVID-19. So he's done a great service for this nation in that respect, and we should be grateful for that.
Let me ask you, I mentioned earlier, Kevin Freeman, that you are the driving force behind a terrific initiative that you call the National Security Investment Consultative Institute. It's designed to help those of us who want to ensure that our money is being used for good purposes as well as remunerative ones. What's the possibility, Kevin, in this environment that we could see Wall Street, which has been massively investing in China for years? You've decried this as a vibe, but it's nonetheless been going on, and it seems as though some of the leaders of that financial sector, Larry Fink, for example, BlackRock, and Steve Schwarzman at Blackstone, and the MSCI, and so on, continue to believe that they need to put our money, our, in some cases our retirement money, into Chinese companies that are at best problematic and at worst possibly complete frauds. Is there now a chance, Kevin, as you see it, that we might see an America First investment approach adopted instead?
Well, the people who have the money want the America First investment approach. They're going to be shocked when they find out how much of their retirement has been invested overseas in potential adversaries and enemies of the United States. So, yes, this is now is the time. Now is the time for people to stand up and call their advisor and say, look, I want to redirect my investments so that I can put America first. We can rebuild manufacturing so that we don't run out of masks and gowns and pharmaceuticals and other things that are necessary. There's a tragedy that could happen because we've grown so dependent on China. Now is the opportunity for us to redirect and put America first, and we can be then helpful to the rest of the world. I'm not opposed to trade. I think trade is excellent, but it's got to be fair trade, and we've not had anything close to that.
And just a quick word about how people can find out more about your investment training capability, Kevin, and getting access to it for their financial advisors.
Well, you should go to nsic.org, nsic.org, and we will be putting more and new information coming up. We're talking to Liberty University, and we're very far along with possibly having them start the training program out of Liberty University. So we're very excited. The potential is tremendous.
The potential is tremendous, and the need is acute, needless to say. As ever, Kevin Freeman, you are at the leading edge of thinking and practice of economic security policy, and we're so grateful to you for what you do for us at the Center for Security Policy, as well as for our country more generally. Check out his work at an absolutely superb program, economicwarroom.com, with Kevin Freeman at Blaze TV. economicwarroom.com is the website. Kevin, again, thank you. We'll talk with you again next week. Next up, we'll talk with Dan Gallington about the state of our nuclear deterrent and ideas about arms control and more. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. It's a delight to say we're joined by Colonel Daniel Gallington, United States Air Force retired, a man who served both in uniform as well as in a variety of civilian positions in both the executive and legislative branches of the United States government, in the Defense Department, in the Department of Justice, and on the Senate Intelligence Committee, where he served as the last bipartisan counsel for the committee. He's a good friend and colleague of many years. We're delighted to have him with us always, especially today when there's some very important things to talk about that are in Dan's portfolio as a nuclear weapons expert and arms control practitioner. Dan Gallington, welcome back. Good to have you, sir. Dan, I wanted to visit with you most immediately about a very stern warning that was issued by the commander of the U.S. Strategic Command. His name is Admiral Charles Richard. We spoke at some length about this with our friend Mark Schneider last week, but I wanted to double back with you as you've had a lot of experience, both on the operational side and, of course, on the policy side with respect to nuclear forces and deterrence and arms control. This admiral said, quote, "Delays in funding key modernization efforts could, quote, result in our need to rebuild nearly from scratch over one or more decades our enterprise talent and infrastructure required to be a nuclear power," unquote. Chilling words indeed, Dan Gallington. And then he proceeded to talk about how we may have to start nearly from scratch if we don't get on with the modernization of our forces quickly. Over one or more decades, our enterprise talent and infrastructure required to be a nuclear power is going to have to be rebuilt. I mean, this is the starkest of warnings. I have to say, as somebody who's been sounding similar warnings for some time, I'm not surprised, but I do think it's some admonitions that must be heeded now. No?
Oh, I agree. And, you know, the thing that the Admiral's comments meant to me was, as the guy who spent time on the Hill watching how the Congress works, and I know you worked there too, but the real question to me is, are we to a point where simply spending a bunch of money isn't going to do what needs to be done? I think the Admiral's talking about infrastructure. The Admiral's talking about expertise. The Admiral's talking about enterprise talents. All those things that you and I, you know, grew up with during the Cold War that we've forgotten about over the last 20 years. Seven administrations. You could, from the time Ronald Reagan left town, we really have sort of, well, but the Cold War's over. You know, we don't need to worry about that. Let's spend our money on other stuff.
You know, Mark Schneider said the other day, Dan, that there is no one now in the so-called nuclear enterprise who has designed and tested a nuclear weapon. Not a single person. Now, it's been coming to that point for some time, but this is stunning. And I have to say, I think most Americans have no clue that we've gotten to such a point. They assume that adults have been running this nuclear enterprise. They've been told endlessly we're the world's only superpower. They assume that has something to do with having viable nuclear forces. But anything but is the case, is it not?
Absolutely. If you look at the technology, for example, that it permeates our existing nuclear triad, if you want to call it that anymore. And there's some, by the way, there's some debate as to whether or not we really have a triad anymore. But if you look at the technology that permeates all three parts of that, you know, you're talking 60s and 70s technology. And even further back, if you talk about the scientific, the weapon design and testing regimes and all that sort of stuff, the pit maintenance, all that kind of thing that you and I worried about, you know, 20 years ago.
And are still worrying about in some cases. But Dan, what I guess I'm anxious to just get your sense of is what you said a moment ago. Is this even at the moment a case of just throwing money at it? Can we rebuild, given that the talent has, in some cases, simply died off or certainly retired, that the facilities in which the maintenance of these kinds of weapons, let alone new ones, might be manufactured, are either non-existent or obsolete, that the laboratories that we've relied upon have gotten, you know, a capacity to build at best sort of by hand, small numbers. I mean, all of this is appalling, really, especially against the backdrop of enormous strategic force modernization programs that have been taking place in both Russia and China in recent years.
Yeah, absolutely. We may just not have a choice, even though an economist or a traditional financial person's assessment might be throwing money at this is not probably the best choice. We may just have no other alternative. We may have to do that for a few years, throw money in the various directions we need to do, and basically pray that the people that get the money and have authority to spend it know what to do and how to spend it. I mean, it really gets down to that. And I'm not optimistic that we're in anything other than a brand new learning curve, for other ways to express it that way, a brand new learning.
That's what the Admiral's talking about, rebuilding from basically scratch. Dan, part of the reason that we've gotten into this fix, I think it's fair to say, is the seduction that arms control was somehow going to minimize the risks of engaging in this kind of, well, the Brits call it busman's holiday, you know, vacation from reality in terms of our needs for a nuclear deterrent. You caught my eye with a piece recently that called for arms control with China. Talk a little bit about the logic of that, given what we have seen, it seems, in the case of this coronavirus, as at the very least evidence that there is a covert and illegal biological warfare program in China, in violation of their arms control treaty commitments under the Biological Weapons Convention, one of the few arms control agreements they've gotten into. Whether that's the cause of the coronavirus or not, it's a problem. No? And talk us through your logic in saying, you know, maybe this is a good idea with China.
Well, first of all, before you throw me in the fire here, Frank, the data that op-ed is 2006. 14 years ago, I suggested that at that period of time, it might be profitable. And I looked at it from a standpoint of trade and economic relationships more than anything else, that it might be profitable for us to think about arms control with the Chinese. And in the article, I said, you know, there are some things that our relationship with China is day and night difference than our relationship with Russia. We never had, and we've never had, an economic relationship with Russia. They've never bought what we sell. We've never bought what they sell. On the other hand, look at our integrated economies we have with China and the supply trade, that sort of thing. I thought that, you know, many years ago that it might be good for us to sit down and with the Chinese and start talking about more than just trade, and also how that might bring in the what I would call the territorial issues, Korea, Taiwan, the militarization of the South China Sea, all the kind of things that have happened since 2006. I think it was a good idea in 2006, and we probably should have done it. Should we do it now? That is, I think, a legitimate question to ask. And I think the president, for example, has already said a number of times that he would prefer us to sit down with the Russians and the Chinese in a tri-party kind of discussion about arms control.
Well, in part, it depends on them, of course, and there's very little evidence that they want to do it. But I also think it's probably the case, if I'm not mistaken, Dan Gallington, that the passage of time, and I apologize for not noting the date of your publication. It says here November 2005, in fact, but whatever it was, it was a long time ago, and there's a lot of water over the dam, as they say, in the meantime. Dan, we have to leave it at that. There's so much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back to us again soon. In the meantime, thank you for your extraordinary service to our country over many years, that included that you're rendering these days. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.